deserted, except for a solitary drinker. I said, "You're an American, aren't you?"
"Yes, and you're from Cornwall? You talk the same way Mark did." I used to tease him about that sometimes, which, of course, put their relationship on a firmer footing.
"Where did you meet him?"
"In Tahiti. I was working a little joint in Papeete."
Mark used to come in with his sidekick, and we got pretty friendly.
"Who was his sidekick?"
"A Swedish guy. Sven someone? But this was, oh, maybe 2 years ago when we first met."
"About the time he left Campbell," I calculated.
I said, "I'm interested in how Mark came to die. Can you tell me anything about it, if it doesn't distress you too much?"
"Oh, that's all right," she said, but it was a tremulous voice.
"I can't tell you a lot. He died of appendicitis out in the Palmutas."
"Did you know that?"
"Yes, but how did you know?"
"I didn't believe it at first, but they let me see the death certificate."
"Who are they? Who told you in the first place?"
"A schooner came in with the news, and I went down to the government bureau to see the proof. You see, I thought he might have just gone away."
"Did the doctor come to Papeete himself, the one who operated on Mark?"
She shook her head.
"Not much point, was there? I mean, it's over 200 miles, and he's the only doctor out there. He wouldn't leave just to bring the news back." This clashed with Kane's story. According to him, the doctor had dealt with the certificate and the authorities. Or had he? I thought back to what Kane had said, that he and his partner Hadley had left it all to the doctor. Perhaps it only meant sending the papers back on the next convenient transport. I said, "Did you know the men on the schooner?" She was silent for a bit, and then said, "Why are you asking me all these questions, Mr. Trevelyan?" "I could say out of natural interest in the death of my only brother, but I won't," I said deliberately. "I think there's something very odd about the whole affair." As I said it, I suddenly wondered if she was a plant, one of the spies of Ramirez, of whom Campbell so often warned me. If so, I'd already dealt a hand I should rather have hidden, and I felt cold at the thought. But it was very hard to imagine this girl as a crook's agent. "You think he was murdered, don't you?"
she asked flatly. I tightened my lips, time for a quick decision, and I thought that I may as well continue. It was already too late to do otherwise.
"You think so too, Miss Nelson?"
There was a long pause before she nodded.
"Yes," she whispered, and started to cry.
I felt better, for some reason. She was ruining her makeup, and surely no spy would do that, not just before making a public appearance. I let her run on for a little while, then took her hand in mine.
"You were living with Mark, weren't you?"
"Yes, I was."
"Oh, God, I loved him," she said.
She was so intense, her grip tightening, that I felt I must believe her.
"Were you happy with him?" I asked. "Was he good to you, Miss Nelson?" Amazingly, a smile appeared.
"Oh, I was. Please, don't call me Miss Nelson. My name is Paula,
and I'm Mike."
We were silent for a few moments, then I said, "What really happened, Paula?" She said, "I suppose it all started when Sven was killed."
"Norgard? Killed?"
"Yes. He was found out on the reef, outside Papeete, with his head bashed in. At first everyone thought it was the sea. It comes in with tremendous force against the reef. They thought he'd been washed off his feet and had his head smashed on the rocks. Then, I don't know exactly how, they decided he'd been murdered. It was something to do with what the police surgeon found."
I nodded grimly.
"Then what happened?"
"Well, the police were asking questions, and they came to Mark. He said he knew nothing about it, but it didn't seem to worry him."
I took a deep breath. "Paula, do you think that Mark killed Sven?"
She hesitated, then shook her head violently.
"No. It couldn't have been Mark. I know he could get very angry, even violent, but he couldn't have killed Sven. They were partners.
I had experienced some of Mark's violence in my younger days. Paula, did he ever hit you?
She looked down at the table, nodding.
Sometimes. But I'm hell to live with. I'm untidy and sloppy about housework.
She laughed, but the laugh broke off on a sob and tears rolled down her cheeks. I was appalled.
What happened then?
Mark ran away. He ran from the police. I don't mean literally, not the day they spoke to him, but that night he disappeared from Tahiti. And then we heard that he was dead. I've already told you exactly how that was.
Who brought the news of his death in that schooner?
It was a man called Hadley. He brought the news. He said that he and his partner had found Mark dying out in the islands.
She had the look of nervousness back, and I thought that it may have been caused by her mention of Hadley. But I had more important things to think about. This was the break. This was the evidence that showed Kane to be a downright liar. There could have been an honest mistake about the death certificate, but not about this. Kane had told me that he and Hadley had left things to the doctor. This was the crack in his story. I said, Hadley's partner, was it a man called Kane?
I don't know. I never met him. I knew Hadley, though. He came to visit Mark often.
The devil he did, I ejaculated. This was a new development.
Oh, sure. Mark and Sven used to hire Hadley's boat and go off for weeks at a time with him.
You've no idea where they went, I suppose, I said casually.
Mark never talked to me about what he did, she said.
There's just one more thing, but it's very important. You said you thought Mark had been murdered. What led you to think that?
It was Hadley, she said. He came to my place and said he wanted Mark's things. The way he talked about Mark, he was so triumphant. I didn't see any reason why he should have Mark's stuff, so I gave him the air. He was mad about it, but he couldn't do anything then because I had friends with me. But he scared me. He's a bad bastard. I looked at Mark's case and there wasn't anything there that would do me any good. So I sent it home to his wife. Mark talked about her to me. There was pain in her voice. He talked about you, too. He wasn't very nice about you. I can imagine.
Did Hadley try again?
Yes. He came and beat the living daylights out of me and searched my place, but of course there wasn't anything there.
You mean he beat you up?
Oh, brother, you ought to have seen the shiner I had. She looked at me gravely.
You don't know much about men like Hadley, do you?
Not yet, I said grimly.
But I soon will. I'm going to catch up with that bastard.
She laughed scornfully. He'd tear you in half, Mike. Be careful of him. Don't come at him from the front. Club him down from behind. He'd do the same to you. He's an uncivilized savage. I looked at this girl who talked of brawls and beatings so matter-of-factly. No wonder she had that permanently shrinking air. Or perhaps it was her manner which attracted violence in the first place.
I'll remember that. She sighed.
Well, then I got real scared because I said too much. You know what I said? I said I had proof that he was lying, that Mark hadn't died the way he said. He looked at me in a real funny way and said he'd be back with friends. So I packed a few things and got out. I stayed with someone else the rest of the night, and next morning there was a trading schooner leaving for Panama at 5 o'clock, and I was aboard by 4. I kept below deck until Papiti was out of sight.
What was your proof, Paula?
She said what I guessed she was going to say. Mark already had his appendix out. I saw the scar. He couldn't have died that way. I knew about that, too. Mark had his appendix out years ago. Paula looked at her watch and jumped to her feet. She still looked ravaged, but she seemed a little calmer now. I have to get back.
Thanks, Paula. You've helped me a lot. Do you think that Hadley killed Mark and Sven Norgard?
I do, she said intensely.
Have you any idea why you should?
She shrugged. No idea, but I'm sure he did it.
Paula, before I leave here, will you write down what you know for me?
I guess so, Mike. I have to be careful.
She wouldn't come into the hotel lounge with me, so I went in alone, ahead of her, and found Geordie sitting talking to Claire.
Pup's gone to bed, she said. It's late and he gets tired.
I hope Geordie's been entertaining you all right?
Oh, yes. He's been telling me more about Mark. And you.
I said lightly. I thought I felt my ears burning. I saw Paula join the trio. In the dim lounge lighting, one could not see any trace of disarray, and she began to sing in the same pleasant, husky voice.
Nice voice she's got, said Claire, casually.
I saw they were both looking at her.
How was your assignation? Asked Geordie.
Interesting. A mischievous smile played briefly on Claire's mouth.
We saw you escorting her out of the foyer.
Her name is P. Nelson, I said. Geordie choked over his coffee. I put Claire in the picture, regarding the name, then said, She's had a lot to tell me, all fascinating. She thinks that Mark was murdered, and his partner Norgard too. Oh yes, he's dead. And she thinks they were both killed by Hadley, this mystery partner of Cain's. But the consensus of opinion in Tahiti seems to be that Mark killed Norgard. Well, that's the official police view. And that Mark died by accident while on the run. It's a hell of a mess.
Good God, said Geordie.
What's she doing here?
Run away from Hadley.
I'll fill you all in the morning. I'm tired. It seemed an age since we had come sailing into Panama, only that morning. Claire looked over towards Paula, who was still singing.
How well did she know Mark?
Pretty well, I said, unthinkingly. She was another of Mark's popses, and could have bitten my tongue out the moment I spoke. 5. Next morning at breakfast, Campbell came down with a cable. He frowned as he read it.
Suarez Navarro have started to move, he said. Their ship has left Darwin, bound for New Guinea.
Geordie said, The Bismarck Archipelago is up that way too.
What's that got to do with it?
We forgot to tell you, I said. Cain sent a cable yesterday to Rabul, which is in the archipelago.
Cain? Maybe to Ramirez, telling him where you are.
Would your nodule deposit be anywhere up near Rabul? Asked Campbell.
There's nothing against it and a few things for it, I said.
Though, personally, I think Mark wouldn't have been so far away from where it is. But from what I could gather from the notebooks, Mark was linking nodule formation with volcanism, and there's a hell of a lot of volcanoes in that part of the world.
Not here?
Oh, yes, all over the Pacific. I'm going to explain that to you when my own ideas are clearer.
Do you think he was right in that theory?
Said Campbell.
I don't know, I admitted. It's all very theoretical.
There's nothing against it in principle,
Campbell muttered. When I get an unqualified answer from a scientist, I suppose the world will be coming to an end. Now, what's all this about the girl last night? Claire's told me a little.
So I filled them all in, and we sat back, aghast and disturbed by the implications in Paula's story. We were running into something which got steadily nastier. Campbell approved of my wanting her evidence written down, preferably legally attested, though I wasn't sure if she would commit herself so far. Claire said, changing the subject,
Mike, I've been giving the diary some thought, and especially the drawings, and I think I've come up with something. Can we all go up to Pop's suite after breakfast? Geordie assented reluctantly. He was anxious to get back to his ship, but we persuaded him that all would be well for a couple of hours more. "They're good lads, plenty to do, and they know where you are if they want you," I said firmly. So after breakfast we found ourselves seated round a coffee table in the suite, already sweating gently in spite of the air conditioning and with the sunshine of Panama calling to us through the open windows. Claire laid out the diary and tracings in front of us. "I've been working backwards from where we know Mark was to see if we can identify any more of the drawings. The very last one is what looks like a monocle, and I think I know what it is, but only because we do know where Mark was. I think it means Tahiti."
"How the hell can it mean Tahiti?" said Campbell.
"They're also known as the Society Islands, and a monocle is the epitome of the upper crust, the society bloke. It's lean, but could it do?" She looked anxiously for my opinion. I laughed, as well as anything. "Crude, but effective. Go on." "Numbers 31 and 30 I can't see at all. Perhaps Geordie might, if he knows the area well. One's a cow, and one's a... well, it's this." She pointed to an object like an irregular, flattened semicircle, standing on a flat base. It was connected to the cow with the word "or," and made no sense at all to any of us. "Then we come to these, the fair goddess, and the disappearing trick, a woman and an eagle." I interrupted her. "They are the two figures that come immediately before his high cobalt assay figures. I think they may be crucial." "Good," she said briskly, "because there are lots more possibilities. I've been thinking about the woman. I think she could be LaFrance, you know, Uncle Sam for America, John Bull for Britain, and this female, Marianne, for France. You see her in the newspaper cartoons." Campbell looked at the drawing intently. "You may have something there. This thing on her head is the Cap of Liberty, isn't it? What's the extent of French territory in the Pacific?"
"French Oceania? About 1 million square miles of it, including Tahiti, Bora Bora, the Tuamotus, Marquesas, the Austral Islands. You'd have to get it down much closer than that."
"The Marianas Islands," said Geordie, and he sounded very glum.
"The Marianas Trench."
Claire looked thrilled.
"Where are they?"
"A long way off, too far for comfort. Almost alongside the Philippines," I said. "It just can't be there. Or else why was Mark so far away from it? I don't believe it." But Geordie had thought of something else.
"Suarez Navarro's ship is heading that way."
We looked at one another in dismay.
"Just doesn't feel right," I said.
"Only because I didn't want it to be.
We want something down this way."
Campbell said,
"What's this about a goddess? Marianne isn't one."
"Let's go through a list of goddesses," I suggested. "There's Venus, for a start. Is there a Venus Island?"
Geordie grinned. "I've heard of the good ship Venus, but not an island."
"Wait a minute, though.
There's a Venus Point in Tahiti."
"That sounds promising," said Campbell.
"It's too close to shore, and all round there has been dredged."
"Not so promising," said Campbell, glumly. "But we'll keep it in mind."
"Let's carry on with the goddess list," said Claire. "What about Aphrodite?"
We all thought about that.
"Nothing doing," said Geordie, finally.
"It could be a French name," said Campbell. I was brutal about it.
"Or a Polynesian name. Or a Polynesian goddess."
"Good grief," said Campbell.
"We're getting nowhere fast."
We ran through the pantheon and couldn't even make a start
on the Polynesian tribal deities without a single degree in anthropology amongst us. We switched our combined brains to the problem of the eagle, got nowhere, and came back to La France. Claire gazed fiercely at the drawings. All right, one last try. Let's go through it all once more. We all groaned.
Venus. Tahiti,
muttered Campbell, whose attention was waning. Demeter. Still nothing doing. Athena. Campbell said,
I think this whole wacky idea is wrong. Let's pack it up.
Claire gave a shout of laughter.
I've got it! She's not La France at all. She's Athena, the goddess of justice. Mark used fair in the sense of fair play.
Not that he knew much about that, Geordie said.
What about the Cap of Liberty? I asked.
It's not. It's a Roman helmet. She ought to have a spear, too.
But Athena wasn't a Roman, objected Campbell. She was a Greek goddess.
I said, the Roman equivalent was Minerva. What about that?
Geordie thumped the table and burst out laughing. My God!
I think that's it. I should have seen it before.
Received a Minerva?
Of course!
Campbell said,
you mean there is such a place?
I was struggling with a memory. I'd read about the place, and there was something very out of whack about it, but I couldn't recall what it was.
Geordie couldn't stop laughing. There's been a shipwreck on it. Oh, this is too damn funny.
Campbell rubbed his hands, his interest rekindled.
Now we're getting somewhere. Where is it? Obviously down this way.
Down south of the Tuamotus, said Geordie.
Is it worth a trip? Campbell asked me. You're the expert here.
I thought that it was only a remote possibility that we'd hit on the right spot on our very first guess, and that there'd probably be a lot of false alarms on the way, unless some much more concrete evidence came up. But on the other hand, I didn't want the expedition to founder through lack of either activity or enthusiasm, and we had to start somewhere. It could have possibilities, I said, voicing a little of my reservation. It partly depends on where it is, which is what Geordie is going to tell us.
Are you kidding? Said Geordie,
still spluttering over his private joke.
Nobody, not even the Royal Navy, knows where Minerva is.
There was a dead silence. Campbell broke it.
What the hell do you mean by that?
I mean this, said Geordie, suddenly sober. The Navy looked for it, but couldn't find it. I suppose it's all in the Pacific Islands pilot. I'd have to look. But there's an account of it in a book I've got on board.
But what is it? Claire asked.
Just what it says. Récif de Minerve. Minerva Reef. It's a hidden shoal.
Geordie left us to go down to Esmeralda. Apart from fetching the book, he was anxious to know if all was well, and to supervise the beginning of the restocking for sea. He also had to arrange for a cabin for Claire, which I knew would mean a little crowding up for someone else. We agreed that we might as well get on with things, and that all being well, we should be able to sail within a day or so. Impatience was in the air. I decided to try and have another word with Paula, who had left a note for me, containing her address. I had another idea that I wanted to try out on her. I used the phone in the foyer and got her at once. Paula, it's Mike. I'd like to talk to you again.
Sure, she said, sleepily.
And I guessed that late night singing meant late mornings lying in.
When? Now?
If I can.
Okay. I'll see you in that little bar up the street.
She was waiting for me, sitting at the same table.
Hi, she said. What's on your mind?
I ordered coffee for both of us. She looked fresh and decidedly less tense this morning, and had obviously decided that I was an ally, as I had concluded about her. Hadley and people like him are on my mind. You're sure you don't remember a man called Kane? She shook her head firmly. Or Ramirez, ever hear of him?
That drew a blank, too. I said, "Look, how well do you know Tahiti, especially Papeete?"
"Pretty well. I was there a long time, Mike."
I rubbed my chin.
"I don't know it well at all, and I certainly don't know Hadley. I could pass him on the street without a second glance. What I need is a pair of eyes."
She said in a small voice, "You want me to go back to Papeete?"
I nodded. "But not without an escort or a backup. Scared of Hadley?"
"I'll say I am. I don't mind admitting it."
I said, "Paula, I'm here on a small ship, crewed by the toughest mob outside of the Mafia, but straight. Most of them are ex-commandos, and any one of them could take Hadley with one arm tied behind his back. We're leaving tomorrow, most likely to sail to Tahiti. If you come with us, I'll assign two of them as your permanent bodyguard when we get there. If Hadley tried anything, he'll learn something he never knew about dirty fighting, and probably end up with a broken back or in jail." I thought that having her on board would be tricky with Kane around, but she said they had never met, and it was worth the risk. If I left her behind, I might never have another chance to use her. "You'll have company, by the way, female company, if you're thinking about that. The girl we were with last night, she's coming too." She bit her lip.
"Oh, Mike, I'd be scared. Besides, I'm on contract here. Though it's up in a couple of weeks, I don't want to run out on a contract. Things like that get about in my business."
I said, "If it's money you're worried about, we'll pay all your expenses, and you'll get a bonus, too. Hell, we can buy out your contract."
"I'm not thinking of money."
"You're really going to find out what happened to Mark, aren't you?"
"I am," I said,
"definitely."
She thought for a moment, then sat back and looked determined.
"Then I'll come. Mark was the only man I've ever loved, and I think he loved me, a little. If he was killed, I'd like to see his killer caught.
Good girl.
Look, why not come over on a cruise ship? Do they go from here to Tahiti? Can you find out?"
"Wait a minute. I'll see if I can find out anything."
It was 5 minutes.
"There's a smallish cruise ship, the Eastern Sun, coming through here, but not for a few weeks. It'll stop at Papeete. I can get a cabin, and I might even get a job for the trip, which would save you cash. But it's a long time off yet."
"Well, that would suit me. I thought we would be a few days before we could really be sure of leaving, and then might be dredging or searching for several weeks around Minerva, Reef, whatever that was." I got the date of the Eastern Sun's arrival in Papeete, and promised Paula that we would be there before her, so that she would not be alone. "I don't want to see you out of pocket," I went on. "I'll pay your fare and expenses. If you get a paid job, you can let me have it back. Do you have a bank?" She told me, and I said, "I'll transfer enough to your account. I'm grateful, Paula. I'm glad to have you on our team. And you don't have to break your contract."
"There's more to this than just Mark's death, isn't there?" she said shrewdly.
"A lot more. I'll tell you about it in Papeete. Perhaps after we've found out more still." A girl like Claire Campbell would have demanded a much greater share of knowledge before committing herself, but Paula seemed accustomed to playing subsidiary roles. As we said goodbye, I wondered how in hell Mark could have attracted such widely disparate women, though they had one thing more than their sex in common. Both seemed determined and courageous, and they were both worthy of a better man than Mark in their lives. I went back to the hotel slowly, looking at shops and enjoying the exotic street scenes around me. I lunched alone, not finding any of the others in, but presently I saw Claire and her father arriving, and soon after we were joined by Geordie carrying a book. Over cold drinks we got down to business once more. The book Geordie had brought from the ship was a copy of Bill Robinson's To the Great Southern Sea. "Here's the bit. I've looked at the pilot, too, but I left that on board for later. I've been rereading Robinson, knowing that would be sailing down this way. He sailed from the Galapagos to Mangareva in his schooner, and here is what he has to say about Minerva. This was published in 1957, not long ago, by the way. He passed the book to Claire, indicating a paragraph. She started to read silently, but her father said, "Oh, for God's sake, read it out aloud so we all know what's going on." So Claire read to us. "Approaching Mangareva, we pass close to Minerva, one of those shoals of doubtful position and uncertain existence known as Vigias. Vigias are the bane of navigators, for one is never sure where they are, or if they are there at all. According to the sailing directions, which neglect to state how she got her name, there seems to be no doubt about Minerva's authenticity. A ship named the Sir George Grey was assumed last there in 1865, although the British Navy failed to locate a reef there a few years later. In 1890, the German bark Erato saw the shoal. It was again seen breaking heavily in 1920, 10 miles from the position reported by the Erato. To my great disappointment, the Marimu spoiled our chances of looking for Minerva, for although the wind had gone down to a fresh breeze, and we arrived at the vicinity at midday, there was still a big sea running, which broke in an unruly fashion. It was impossible to distinguish breakers caused by a shoal from those left in the wake of the Marimu. We steered a course that took us 10 miles to the north of the northernmost reported position of the errant shoal, kept a vigilant lookout, but saw nothing." Claire stopped reading, and Campbell said, "Well, I'm damned. Do you mean to tell me that while spacemen are whirling round in orbit, and we're on the verge of going to other planets, that there's a peddling little shoal like this that hasn't been located?" "That's right," said Geordie. "There are lots of them." "It's disgusting," said Campbell, more accustomed to precise locations on land. "But if Mark found it, we can find it." "If he did, I doubt it," I said. "If an IGY survey ship had found Minerva, they'd have reported it, and they didn't. But it doesn't mean they didn't dredge around it." I added hastily, into 3 disappointed faces. "You've heard what Robinson said about it. You'd probably only be able to see it in a flat calm with the tides right." "Robinson took damn good care to stay well clear of it," snorted Campbell. 10 miles north of its reported position, indeed." "He was a wise man and a good seaman," said Geordie. "He didn't want to lose his ship. It might be a shifting shoal, and if you can't see where it is, it's a good idea to keep clear of it. I'll do the same, believe me." Once again, they all looked at me, the reluctant expert. "The conditions I'm thinking of are possible," I said. "We have to make a start somewhere, and it would be fun to find it, if we can. Why not?" One more thing happened before we left Panama. Kane came to see me. We had ostensibly treated him as just one of the crew, and he'd done his work well, and was not a bad seaman. But Geordie had only agreed to take him as far as Panama, and now we were waiting to see what his next step would be. He came down to my cabin one morning and said, "Mr. Trevelyan, could I have a word?" "Come in." He looked fit again. Without trying to show it, I had kept clear of him on the voyage, finding it intolerably creepy to have the possible murderer of Mark underfoot. But I couldn't avoid some contacts, and this was one I had almost been hoping for. "What is it?" "You're carrying on this research stuff, aren't you?" "That's right. As you know, we're leaving in a day's time." "There was a message waiting for me here in Panama from my partner, Jim Hadley. Jim's down in New Guinea, and he says he can't come up this way for a while. Now,
I know you only promised to bring me as far as here, and I'm grateful, my word I am. But I wondered if I could stick with her a bit longer. You'll need a man of my birth anyway. Maybe you'll be putting in some place that's nearer for Jim. Tahiti, maybe. That'd suit us both.
I said, I don't see a problem. You're welcome to stay on as far as I'm concerned, if it's all right with the skipper.
Oh, gee, thanks, Mr. Trevelyan. I know I keep asking favours, and you help me out every time.
Well, there's no favour. We will need a man. You work well, and you earn your keep. But it's up to Mr. Wilkins, mind.
Too right. I'll check with him. Thanks again.
I passed the word to Geordie to accept the expected offer, and told Campbell about it.
Right. We'll keep him under our thumb, he said. Not much chance of him knowing where we're going if we don't know, and he can't pass the word on from out there.
So friend Kane stayed on with us, and the next day we sailed on a voyage of uncertain duration to an unknown destination which might or might not exist. 4. According to local knowledge, the Récif de Minerve was nothing but a legend, and not an uncommon one at that. The pilot's preface on Vigias showed that there were probably masses of them around, but certainly it said that in 1880, HMS Alert had searched the area in which it was said to lie, without any success. And she wasn't the only one. Several ships had looked for it, some had found it, but it was never quite in the same spot twice. We left Panama and made good time at first, but in a day or so found ourselves becalmed in a sea of glass. We stuck it for 24 hours and then went ahead under power. Campbell didn't like clichés about painted ships on painted oceans, especially after I told him another legend concerning the ship that had floated in the Gulf of Panama for 40 years, until she rotted and fell apart. Using the engines was a pity, because there would be so much less fuel for station-keeping and dredging, but in Campbell's view, time was as precious as fuel, and I couldn't disagree with him. I had Paula to think of. Campbell had sent a spate of cables to his ferrets, advising them that they must keep their eyes on the movements of Suarez Navarro's ship, and once we were at sea, he became nervous. I think he was unused to being cut off from the telephone. He haunted the radio, but though he needed news, he half didn't want to get it, and he certainly didn't want to answer. We had a powerful radio telephone that he had insisted on installing. It was an electronic shout that could cover the Pacific, but he didn't want us to use it for fear the Suarez Navarro would monitor the broadcasts. News did finally come that they had dropped anchor in Port Moresby in Papua, and, as in Darwin, were sitting tight and doing nothing. Campbell was as worried by their inactivity as he would have been if they had been constantly on the move. We all felt better when Esmeralda surged forward under the impact of her engine. She forged through the placid seas at a steady 9 knots to where we would catch the southeast trade wind and find perfect sailing weather. It wasn't long before we picked up a southerly wind, and we headed southwest under 4.5 sails only, Esmeralda heeling until the foaming sea lapped at the lee rail. As the days went by, the wind shifted easterly until the day came when we knew we were in the true trade winds. We hoisted the big square sails on the foremast, and Esmeralda picked up her heels. These were Kane's home waters, and while we didn't depend on him, he was free with his advice on weather conditions to be expected.
"A bit further on, we'll get revolving storms," he said. "Not to worry. They're not very big, but my word, they're fast. On you like a flash, so you gotta keep your eyes peeled."
Campbell turned out to be a poor sailor, and spent a great deal of time on his bunk, regretting that ships were ever invented. It was unusual for him not to be the master of the situation, and he said he felt like a spare wheel on deck, surrounded by men who were doing all sorts of mysterious things, fast and well, without his guidance.
He must have been hell to his mining engineers on land.
Claire, on the other hand, was a good sailor. She worked hard on deck, wearing the battered sailing gear she had promised us, and a healthy tan, and was greatly appreciated by all the crew, who had found her an unexpected bonus on this leg of the voyage. She did help cook and kept watch like the rest of us, but she also absorbed the books in our small library like blotting paper, becoming especially interested in Geordie's collection of small boat voyages, many of which dealt with the Pacific. One evening, she and I talked together, and I got another look at my brother through Claire's eyes. It was one of those incredible nights you find in the tropics. There was a waning moon, and the stars sparkled like a handful of diamonds cast across the sky. The wind sang in the rigging, and the water talked and chuckled to Esmeralda, and a white foamed wake with patches of phosphorescence stretched astern. I was standing in the bows when Claire joined me. She looked across the sea path of the moon and said, "I wish this voyage would go on forever." "It won't. There's a limit even to the size of the Pacific." "When will we ever get to Minerva?" "Perhaps never. We've got to find it first. But we'll be in the vicinity in a week if the weather keeps up." "I hope we were right about that drawing," she said. "Sometimes I wish I hadn't tried interpreting them. What if we're wrong?" "We'll just have to think of something else." Figuring out Mark's mental processes was never an easy job at the best of times. She smiled. "I know." "How well did you know Mark?" "Sometimes I thought I knew him pretty well," she said. "In the end, I found I didn't know him at all." She paused. "Pop doesn't think much of what you've said about Mark. About his honesty, I mean. Pop thought well of him. Mostly." I said, "Mark had many faces. He was working for your father and he wanted something out of him, so he showed his cleanest, brightest face. Your father never really knew Mark." "I know." "Speaking figuratively and with due respect to your mother, Mark was a thoroughgoing bastard." I was startled and, at the same time, unsurprised. "What happened?" She said reflectively, "I was a bit bitchy the other night, and then you pulled me up with a jerk when you called that singer just another of Mark's popses. You see, I suppose I could be regarded as just another of Mark's popses. It was the usual thing. It must happen 1,000 times a day somewhere in the world, but when it happens to you, it hurts. I went overboard for Mark. I was all wrapped up in rosy dreams. He was so damned attractive. Yeah, when he wanted to be. He could switch the charm on and off like a light. He let it happen, damn him," she said. "He could have stopped it at any time, but the devil let it happen. I was hearing the distant chimes of wedding bells when I discovered he was already married. Maybe not happily, but married." I said gently, "He was using you, too, to get at your father. That's not surprising behavior from Mark. I know that now. I wish to God I'd known it then. Mark and I had a lot of fun in those days, and I thought it was going to go on forever. Do you remember meeting you in Vancouver?" "Oh, yes." "I wondered then why you didn't seem to get on. You seemed so cold. I thought you were the rotter. And he said things..." "Never mind all that." "What happened?" She shrugged. "Nothing. Nothing at all. And I found out at about the same time that Pop was having his troubles with Suarez Navarro, so I didn't tell him or anyone, though I think he guessed something. Have you noticed that he only praises Mark as a scientist, not as a person? And then Mark vanished." "That's right. He'd gone, and I never saw him again." She looked ahead over the bows. "And now he's dead. His body lies somewhere out there. But he's still pushing people around. We're all being pushed around by Mark, even now. Do you know that? You and me, Pop and the Suarez Navarro crowd, your friend Geordie and all your commando pals, all being manipulated by a dead man with a long arm." "Take it easy," I said. She sounded terribly bitter. "Mark's not pushing anyone.
We all know what we're doing, and we're doing it because we want to. Mark is dead, and that's an end to him. It was time to change the subject. I used the standard approach. Tell me about yourself, Claire. What do you do? When did your mother die? When I was 6. Who brought you up? Your father was away a lot, wasn't he? She laughed. I've been everywhere with Pop. He brought me up. Well, that must have been some experience. Oh, it was fun. I had to spend a lot of time at boarding schools, of course, but I always went to Pop during the vacations. We weren't often at home, though. We were mostly away. Sometimes on a skiing holiday, sometimes to Europe or Australia or South America during the longer vacations. I was always with Pop. You're well-travelled. It was tricky at times, though. Pop has his ups and downs. He hasn't always been rich. Sometimes we had money and sometimes we didn't. But Pop always looked after me. I went to good schools and to college. It was only last year that I found out that once, when Pop was on a crest, he'd put aside a fund for me. Even when he was busted, he never touched it, no matter how much he needed money. He sounds a fine man. I love him, she said simply. When the Suarez Navarro mob put the knife into him, it was the first time I was old enough to understand defeat. I got down to studying stenography, and so on, and he made me his confidential secretary when he couldn't afford to hire one. It was the least I could do. He'd lost faith in everybody, and he had to have someone around he could trust, although I didn't feel too trusting myself just about that time. He seems to have survived. He's tough, she said proudly. You can't keep Pop down, and you can bet that in the end, Suarez Navarro will be sorry they ever heard of him. It's happened to him before, and he's always bounced back. I still work for him. Whatever it is, say it. I had you checked out in London when you were preparing for this trip. I didn't want Pop stung again. Besides, my name was Trevelyan. Oh, I'm so sorry, she said, but I had to. You checked out fine, you know. For the first time since I'd known her, she was a little shy. She went on. Well, that's enough about the Campbells. What about the Trevelyans? About you? What about me? I'm just a plodding scientist. We both laughed. Plodding certainly didn't describe this airy swooping progress, and it eased her tension. Most scientists seem to be looking up these days, not down. Ah, space stuff, I said. You don't seem very enthusiastic. I'm not. I think it's a waste of money. The Americans are spending $30 billion of dollars to put man into space. In the end, it could cost 10 times that much. That works out at about $20,000 for every square mile of airless lunar surface. You could get cheaper and better land on Earth, and if you poured that much money into the sea, the returns would be even better. I think the sea is our new frontier, not space. She smiled at the missionary note in my voice. So that's why you became an oceanographer. I suppose so. I was always in love with the sea. And Mark? What made him one? I don't think I've ever known two brothers more different. I said, Mark was eaten up with ambition. How he got that way, I don't know. I think some of it was jealousy of me, though God knows what he had to be jealous about. When my father died, Mark seemed to go wild. Mother couldn't control him. Since she died, I've had nothing to do with him. He went his way and I mine. It hasn't always been easy having a brother like that in my line of work. People sometimes confuse us, to my detriment. And his advantage. Why, thank you, lady, I said, and bowed. And our relationship suddenly took a step forward. Trevelyan, that's Cornish, isn't it? Are you Cornish? Yes, we're descended from the Phoenician and Carthaginian tin traders. Hannibal is still a popular name in Cornwall, though not in our family, thank God. You're kidding. No, I'm not. It's a fact. We had a long, relaxed and easy conversation that night.
talking about everything under the sun and moon, and by the time she went back to her cabin, I had a better idea about both Claire and her father. Campbell was a difficult man to assess, not very forthcoming about himself, and sticking to business most of the time. This talk with Claire had given me something of his background, and I felt more than ever that he was a man to be trusted. And then there was Claire herself. I found myself wondering if she could bring herself to trust another Trevelyan, or whether Mark had soured her on Trevelyans for life. I mentally chalked up another stroke against Mark. I spent a long time thinking about Claire before I turned in. And then I suddenly thought of what she had said about Mark, of his dead hand pushing people around like pawns on a chessboard. It was true. Everything we had done, or were doing, stemmed from Mark and his character. It was as though Mark had been a showman, and we were his puppets, as his skeletal hands pulled the strings. It was a shuddery thought to go to sleep on. 2. We entered a region of small revolving storms, as Kane had predicted. They ranged from mere waterspouts, 10 yards across, to monsters 50 feet in diameter. These squalls provided exhilarating sailing, as long as care was taken. Esmeralda would be foaming along beneath a brilliant blue sky, when the horizon would darken, and within minutes the water would be dark and wind-lashed, and when the storm had gone, there would be rainbows plunging into the sea, and the faithful trade wind would pick up again, driving us deeper into the heart of the Pacific, towards the southeast corner of French Oceania. 16 days after leaving Panama, Geordie figured out the midday sights and announced, "We're nearly there. We'll enter the search area this afternoon." We had decided not to tell the crew too much, and so Geordie gathered them and merely said that I wanted to stooge about looking for a particular sort of water condition, but that everyone was to be on the watch for shoals. Everyone knew there wasn't much land out here, and his request may have sounded strange, but they willingly organised for extra eyes on each watch, and we had a man at the foremast with binoculars a lot of the time. To my mind, that was just a token that a search was in progress, as I didn't think they'd spot anything, but for everyone else, it perked up interest. We arranged for some dredging, to give the teams practice as we went along. I was in the chart room early the next morning with Campbell and Geordie, going over the chart and the pilot. I said, "The Arato spotted Minerva here." That was in 1890. In 1920, another ship placed Minerva here, stretching east-northeast for 2 miles. As Robinson points out, there's a difference of 10 miles. Campbell said, "It's strange that there should only have been 2 sightings in 30 years. "Not so strange," said Geordie. "These waters are pretty quiet, and they're quieter now that power is taken over from sail. There's no need for anyone to come here just for commerce." He put his hand on the chart. "There are several possibilities. One of these sightings was right, and the other wrong. Take your pick of which was right. Or they were both wrong, or they were both right, and Minerva is a moving shoal, which happens sometimes. Or they were both wrong, and Minerva is still a moving shoal," I said dubiously. "Or there are 2 shoals, offered Campbell. We all laughed. "You're getting the idea," said Geordie. He bent to the chart again. "Now, we'll put each of these sightings into the middle of a rectangle, 10 miles by 20. That'll give us 200 square miles to search, but it'll be sure. We'll start on the outside and work our way in." Campbell said, "Let's get to the heart of the matter. Let's go right to each of these positions and see what's there." But Geordie decided against that. "It depends on the weather. I'm not going anywhere near those 2 positions unless the sea is pretty near calm. You read what Robinson said about not being able to distinguish breakers from storm waves. We might find her too quickly and rip the bottom out of Esmeralda. We've got the echo sounder," I said. "They should tell us where the water's shoaling." "Damn it!
"You're the oceanographer," said Geordie. "You should know that these islands are the tops of undersea mountains. There'll probably be deep water within a quarter of a mile of Minerva, and we could be sailing in 20 fathoms and a spire of coral could rip our guts out."
"You're right, Geordie. Minerva's probably a budding atoll. Give her another 1,000,000 years and she'll be a proper island."
"We can't wait 1,000,000 years," said Campbell acidly. "All right, you're the skipper. We'll do your square search." So we got on with it. Geordie estimated that we'd have to pass within 1 mile of Minerva in order to see it. That meant we'd have to cover about 100 miles in order to search a 200-square-mile area. We used the engine as sparingly as possible, confined our speed to about 5 knots and less, and that way a daylight search would take about 2 days. The first leg of the search gave us nothing, and in the evening we hove to, knowing that it would be the devil of a job to assess our actual position the next morning, because of the rate of drift in this area, and an uncertainty factor of at least 1 knot. Geordie pointed this out to Campbell to make him realise that this wasn't like searching a given area of land, which at least stays put. Campbell hated it. That evening, relaxing on deck, I was bombarded with questions by the crew as we ate our evening meal. They were all curious, and I thought that this was not a satisfactory way to deal with them. They'd be more use and have more enthusiasm if they were in the know, of one piece of the story at least. And I was also curious myself as to Kane's reaction, and he happened to be among the off-watch members.
"What is all this, Mike?" Ian Lewis asked.
"Yeah, what are we poking about here for?" I glanced at Geordie, caught his eye, and nodded very slightly. "All right, chaps, we're looking for something a bit offbeat." They were intent, and I knew I was right to share this with them. "Ever hear of Minerva?" I asked. It brought no reaction but murmurings and headshakes from all but one. Kane raised his head sharply.
"Received in Minerva,"
he said in a barbarous French accent. Everyone turned to look at him now.
"Are you looking for that?" "My word, I wish us all luck then,"
he chuckled, enjoying his moment of superiority.
"What is it?"
I told them briefly what we were after, and its tantalizing history.
"What's the idea anyhow?"
Danny Williams wanted to know. I said, "Well, this is an oceanological expedition, and chaps like me are always interested in mysteries. Well, that's how we make our living. The waters round a newly forming island are fascinating, you know." They accepted this, though I did hear Danny say softly to his nearest companion, "I've always thought there was something crazy about these scientific types, and this isn't making me change my mind." Presently everyone fell silent, if a little more alert to the night sea around them, and it was then that Kane came over to join me, dropping his voice very slightly to address me alone.
"This got anything to do with your brother, Mr. Trevelyan?"
he asked, as though idly. I was wary.
"Why do you ask?" "Well, he was in the same line of business, wasn't he? And he died not very far from here. Wasn't he looking for something with another bloke?"
I looked into the darkness towards the northeast, where the Tuamotus lay 100 miles on the other side of the invisible horizon. "Yes, he died near here, but I don't think that he had anything to do with this. I'm not the boss, you know. This is Mr. Campbell's party." Kane chuckled derisively.
"Looking for Minerva. That's like looking for a nigger in a cold black cellar. The little man who wasn't there."
He stayed on for a bit, but getting nothing more from me, he moved away, and I could hear him chuckle again in the darkness. I realised that my fists had been clenched at my sides. Next day, we were up before the sun, waiting to take a sight and hoping there would be no clouds. Taking a dawn sight is tricky and a bit uncertain, but we had to know, if possible, how far we had drifted during the night, or the search would be futile. I was with Geordie, holding his stopwatch, as I told him about Kane's query. "Becoming inquisitive, isn't he?" he commented.
I don't know. It was a natural question. I'm not sorry at all, the lads, by the way. Otherwise they'd be getting edgy. If you were on board a ship that suddenly started to go in circles in the middle of the Pacific, you'd like to know why, wouldn't you? But I wonder about Keane. He tied it up with Mark pretty fast.